Let's do it.
Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With it till 3 on a football Friday with plenty to get to over the next few hours. Coming up, the Braves and Dodgers are going back to Atlanta. How nervous are you if you're a Braves fan? Plus, last night's Thursday night football game may not have been great, but I think it showed us or told us something about what to expect here moving forward for a lot of teams in the NFL. We'll get to our best matchups of the football weekend, what Zeb Nolan starting for the Gamecocks this weekend means for the program. We'll check in on name, image, and likeness. We'll get ready for Clemson and Pittsburgh. We'll get ready for the Gamecocks and Texas A&M. I'll give you my picks. We'll preview all the games of Week 7 in the NFL season. We'll check in with someone who covers Pittsburgh football and someone who covers Texas A&M football to get the opponent's scouting report and a whole lot more over the next few hours. We got plenty to do on a football Friday, and you can join the conversation throughout the afternoon. 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays, on Facebook at ESPN Charleston, via email studio@kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page, and there you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or you can even take the Morrow Midday show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Friday, Joe's on the steel wheels. Joe, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, it's a football Friday. Can it get any better than that, man?
It cannot.
No, no way.
Absolutely not. Football Friday, playoff baseball going on. If you're a Braves fan, maybe you're a little stressed today after what happened last night. Let me start with that. Let's start with what we saw last night in both football and baseball. The Braves fall 11-2 against the Dodgers, and this series is going back to Atlanta. Last night started fine. Freddie Freeman hits that early home run. Max Fried has a scoreless first inning. They're up 2-0, looking like they're on their way to another good performance in L.A., and then the wheels came off. And the Dodgers score 11 runs on 17 hits over the next 7 innings. That offense finally broke out. You know, just as they say, it's hard to keep a good man down. For the Dodgers, it's hard to put them away. This time of year, it's all about the scary movies. What always happens in all these horror films? You think you killed Michael Myers? Right, think back to the original Halloween. Jamie Lee Curtis, they didn't even know who he was at the time. They were calling him the Boogeyman. And Jamie Lee Curtis, like, jabs him with the hanger in the eye when he's trying to get into the closet. And he falls over, and she goes running out to the kids. Don't worry, it's over. I took care of the Boogeyman. And meanwhile, what happens in the background? Michael Myers sits back up, and he throws the coat hanger away, and he grabs his steak knife, and he gets back to his feet, and you realize, oh, no, this isn't over. He's not dead just yet. And if you continue to watch that film series, you realize you can't kill Michael Myers. Then a cult gets involved. It gets really ridiculous. But all horror films are like that. Just when you think, in fact, they make fun of it in the movie Scream. Just when you think it's over and there's the happy ending and you're in the clear, they come back. At the end of Friday the 13th, here comes Jason diving out of the water and pulling the girl in from the boat. Right? Just when she thought she was safe, she was floating out in the middle of the river in Crystal Lake in her little boat, and here comes Jason flying out of the bottom of the lake to pull her under with him. You're never safe. It's never over. The bad guy in these horror films this time of year, they're never dead. And that's the Dodgers. They have won 7 straight elimination games now in the playoffs. It's the 3rd longest streak in Major League Baseball history, but here's the catch. The other 2 longer streaks have been over a series of years. For the Dodgers, they've done it in 2 years. They're the only team to have this streak in elimination games over just a 2-year stretch. And here's the other thing. Those other 2 teams that have the longer streaks, they won multiple World Series. The Dodgers won the World Series last year. Now they continue this run of avoiding elimination. Could it lead to another World Series here this year? Not what you want to hear if you are a Braves fan, but that's the history, that when a team is this good at surviving and avoiding being put away, and they play this well in these elimination games, in these big moments, it usually leads to multiple championships, because that's what it takes to be a champion, right? When you just can't put them away. Just when you think you got them, like Michael Myers, he's sitting back up in the backdrop of the scene while you're celebrating, right? You're hugging the kids thinking, we're okay. Nope, here he comes again. Here come the Dodgers. They've won 22 of their last 27 at home against the Braves, and the offense woke up last night. Max Fried, meanwhile, just didn't have it. You felt good going into this game if you're a Braves fan. You had Fried on the mound, your ace. The Dodgers are going with a bullpen game. And I've been complaining all week like an old man yelling at the clouds of how much I hate these bullpen games. But you know what? I guess I'm all wrong. Because the Astros essentially went with a bullpen game the other night. They got only 5 outs from Zach Greinke. And then went the bullpen the rest of the way. They won a big game in the ALCS. The Braves won the other night with a bullpen game. Then the Dodgers follow it up and win their bullpen game. So I guess I have it all wrong. I guess I have to get with the times. Maybe that is the way to go. But going into that matchup, you felt pretty good. You have Fried on the mound. He's rested and ready. The Dodgers are throwing Joe Kelly, who couldn't even make it out of the first inning, and then using nothing but relievers. You felt pretty good about that opportunity. And yet, the Braves didn't score after that first inning, mustered only 5 hits, and the Dodgers, their bats finally came alive. The bats that have been struggling all postseason. And that's what could be concerning. You know, is this LA waking up? But Max Fried just didn't have it last night. You know, as I tell you many times, I've spent years working in minor league baseball. And you would always do your pregame interviews, and you would interview the manager or sometimes the pitching coach or some sort, you know, different player. Or you do a postgame interview with the catcher or reliever. You get the idea. And whenever you would ask about that pitcher, right, what do you need to see from your starting pitcher tonight? Or what did you see from your starting pitcher tonight? The number one answer, to the point where it would be mocked by us broadcasters in minor league baseball, because we always knew the answer, the number one thing everybody would always say, fastball command. That's all. It's that simple. Right? What do you need to see from your pitcher tonight? What will tell you that your guy is on? Fastball command. Doesn't matter if he doesn't have his breaking stuff, if his pitches are moving or not. If he can command his fastball, he'll be okay. If he can't command his fastball, he's going to be in big trouble. Everything is built off of that fastball. And for Max Fried, those 2 homers he surrendered, go back and look, they were fastballs right down the middle. He did not have his fastball command. And when a pitcher doesn't have their fastball, they can't locate their fastball, right, when it's just over the plate like that, they're doomed. That is hard to try to navigate through. And for Fried, it was his worst start in months. He just didn't have it. And sometimes you don't. For the Braves, fortunately, they still have the lead, and they're heading home. But as we know, we could turn it into a drinking game, and you wouldn't be able to go back to work for the second half of the day if you had to take a drink every time I told you momentum is only as good as your next day's starting pitcher. And that's why baseball, especially in this postseason, has been really hard to predict. The Red Sox bats were on fire. They jumped up 2-1. They've been shut out the last two nights. And the Astros, whose offense was struggling, have blown them out. And now the Astros are in the driver's seat. Similar with the Braves and the Dodgers. The Dodgers' bats have been silent. You have Max Fried on the mound. You have a bullpen game for the Dodgers, and yet that's the one in which they go for 17 hits against the Braves' ace. And in their bullpen game, when Joe Kelly can only get 2 outs, they toss maybe their best performance of the series. Better than Walker Buehler, better than even Max Scherzer's game. As they say, that's baseball. That's the old cliche. When you can't explain something, you just simply say, hey, that's baseball. And that really is. You can't explain it. So when it comes to the next couple of games, right, you would think the Dodgers have the momentum. Hey, maybe the Dodgers' bats have woken up now. We have no idea. Game 6 coming up tomorrow. For all we know, the Braves will now win 10-0. You have no idea. You can't predict this sport one game to the next, because it all comes down to, does your pitcher have it? Last night, Max Fried did not. And the Braves didn't stand much of a chance. If Max Scherzer doesn't have it in Game 6, then the Dodgers are in big trouble. But the hope, the expectations, when you talk about a star pitcher like that, more often than not, they will have their good stuff. But the Braves are heading home now. They haven't lost back-to-back games in over a month. So, if you stripped off the name of the team, you feel pretty good about them. If this was anybody else, even if this was the Dodgers, especially after winning the World Series, you feel pretty good going home up 3-2. Like the Astros. The Astros are feeling pretty good going home right now up 3-2. But when it's the Braves, and you have last year, and you have the history of the Georgia sport struggles, you worry about them. Right? Last year, same exact thing happened. They went up 2-0, lost Game 3, bounced back in Game 4, and then lost Game 5. And as the series progressed, they lost Game 6. And we know that they lost Game 7. Same exact thing unfolding here. Went up 2-0, right? Lost Game 3, bounced back big in Game 4, got trounced last night in Game 5. Now it's going to happen in Game 6 and 7. The difference is, last year was a neutral site. Now at least you'll get to be home in front of the crowd to try to minimize that choking. Up 3-1 for the second straight year. You feel good heading home up 3-2, but you also have in the back of your mind exactly what happened last year. If you're an Atlanta sports fan or a Georgia sports fan, you've been through this countless times. You know not to count your rings before they are earned. And you have to deal with Max Scherzer and Walker Buehler the next two nights. And if it gets to a Game 7, it'd be hard to believe that Walker Buehler would pitch that poorly in back-to-back starts in the same series as he did the other night. For the Braves, Game 6 tomorrow night is the must-win. Right? For the Dodgers, obviously, it's a must-win. They have to extend their season. But I think for the Braves as well, you do not want this to go to the seventh game. Because once you do, all the pressure, if it isn't already, is on you. You started this series as an underdog. The Dodgers have 20 more wins than you. The Dodgers were the favorites. But once you go up 3-1 and now up 3-2 heading home, it's on you to finish this thing off. And if you lose tomorrow night and you go to Game 7 with Walker Buehler on the mound and what happened last year, and you're thinking, oh boy, here we go again, and the Dodgers have won the last two, and maybe the bats have gotten going finally, the pressure is all on the Braves in Game 7. And in a big spot like that, as good as the players are in the Braves, and you have a veteran like Freddie Freeman and you have a veteran Charlie Morton would be on the mound in Game 7, I still think I would trust the Dodgers with that star power in a winner-take-all Game 7 when at that point, L.A., you can make the case, by then, they kind of be playing with house money. The Braves need to just finish this thing off tomorrow. It's why I said finish it last night. You have Max Fried on the mound. I know you're on the road in L.A. Don't even worry about going home to play more baseball in this series. Finish it off last night. Go for the jugular. Put them away while you can. Get some extra rest. Punch your ticket to the World Series, and don't even worry about this. But now you have to fly home. You got a Game 6 tomorrow. You got Max Scherzer on the mound. You're hearing about what happened last year. The pressure will be on the Braves, and it'll only continue to increase the longer this goes. You have to finish off Game 6. Here was Freddie Freeman talking to the media after the game. Of course, he was asked about all of this, and this was Freddie Freeman talking about the narrative and trying to kill this narrative of the Braves choking these 3-1 leads to the Dodgers.
Last year, or 28-3, or any of Atlanta sports history, but at the same time, do you just have to kill that narrative like you did the division series narrative last year?
I mean, that's going to be the narrative, it seems, because every day it's brought up the last couple of days, so I don't think we have a choice until we kill that narrative. We're up 3-2, and we're going home. It's a great position to be in.
Okay, next question for these guys.
Yeah, just to follow that up, we saw how you responded after the Game 3, you know, crushing loss. How do you think you guys will go home and respond to the crowd and everything there?
I think we're going to be just fine. We got Ian on the mound. You know, he's already itching to get going. Got a long day tomorrow. Got to fly home, but we all get to do that. So we're going to be looking forward to getting in front of our home fans. Just really two good teams. It's going to be a good series, just like we thought. So coming down to Game 6 and 7.
Freddie, for you personally, I know some of this goes without saying, but you've been a Brave for 12 years. To take this final step that we've been talking about and get to the World Series, what would that mean to you for your career?
I don't like hearing 12 years. That's a long time. It means I'm getting toward the end, but it would be nice. We've been so close, you know, obviously with last year, and we're one win away. So it's been a long time since the Braves have been in the World Series, so it's going to mean a lot if we can get there.
Freddie Freeman after last night's loss for the Braves. The Braves need to win Game 6 and punch that ticket to the World Series. Don't let this go on any longer. By the way, the only time we've had back-to-back postseasons where a team, not necessarily the same team, but any team, erased a 3-1 deficit in back-to-back years, it only happened one other time in baseball, 2003 and 2004. 2003, you had the Marlins come back against the Cubs in the NLCS. That's remembered as the Steve Bartman series. Iconic, historic, and the following year in 2004, even more historic, the Red Sox erasing a 3-0 deficit to the Yankees. That's the only other time that in back-to-back seasons, one team, any team, blew a 3-1 deficit in a playoff series. And it was two historic, crazy series. The Red Sox did something we've never seen in sports, and Steve Bartman. You can blame him. It wasn't his fault, but it was a quirky, odd play. And then an error on a ground ball double play to Alex Gonzalez opened the door. Long story short, a historic choke for the Cubs in 2003. Only other time it's happened. Last year, the Braves coughed up a 3-1 deficit. Now, they're up 3-2 trying to avoid the same thing. If the Dodgers do pull this off, it'd be something we haven't seen before. And the only other time anything's come close, it was a very couple of a historic series. That's what's on the line in this series. And don't forget, Dave Roberts is the manager of the Dodgers. He, of course, was involved in that stretch with the 2004 Red Sox getting the big stolen base to help them come back down 3-0. The Braves, don't let it get to Game 7. Finish it off tomorrow. And because of their history, and because of the matchup, and because you jumped out to that early lead, the pressure is on them heading home. Finish it tomorrow. Don't let it go any longer. But the Dodgers, here around Halloween, they're like the bad guy in all those scary movies. Just when you think they're done, they're getting back up again and coming after you. A 7 straight elimination game victories for the Dodgers, third longest in Major League Baseball history. Coming up, I do have some thoughts on Thursday Night Football from last night. We'll get to that a little bit later on. Wasn't the most exciting game, but I think it shows something about the league and what we can expect moving forward. But when we come back, we do it every Friday. I'll give you the 5 most interesting matchups of this football weekend, and we'll do it next. It's the Moore Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Yo, what up?
What's the word, big fella? Everything's good on this end.
Hey, Luke, how's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Luke. Hey, man. Pleasure to be on your show.
I'm doing great, but I'm hoping you could call me Boca Baby.
Great show. You did a good job.
You're turning into rapidly my favorite person I've interviewed with, and I've done like 50 of these in the last week.
You've done your homework. I like it. I absolutely like it. I love that.
Another great thought.
You've done your homework, haven't you? Good job.
You've always get these big stars and important people on. That's great to hear. We'd like to hear the interviews.
You know, it's uncanny how you do this, Luke. And I don't know how you do, because I do this gauntlet of radio on Thursdays, where I do all these different cities. Many of them need their hosts to have me give them some talking points. You hit all my talking points every week. It's uncanny how good you are.
Always great talking football with you, Luke. Appreciate you guys being right.
Very impressive.
Shout out to all the people in Charleston that support the show.
Tell your friends. Tell your friends.
Da 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 da. Da 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 da. Go ahead, boy. That's why you bring it on.
Is this a sports show or a dancing show?
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know what we're doing around here.
Lunch with Luke for 3 hours. Anything goes.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, the best football matchups of the weekend. It's the Moore Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. I'll let you know what those games are here in just a few moments. The Moore Midday Show is brought to you by Baker Roofing. They have been in business for over 100 years. They're one of the largest, most recognized roofing contractors in the U.S., and they provide residential and commercial roofing. In 1915, Baker Roofing Company was founded on the promise of always good work. So give our friend Matt Johnson, general manager at Baker Roofing Charleston, a call, or head on over to bakerroofing.com for more info. Check out their incredible history. See all the different roofing types that are available online right there at bakerroofing.com. Over 100 years of always good work. Baker Roofing, bringing you the Morrow Midday Show each and every day. Every Friday on this show, I put together my top 5 list for you, the most interesting games for the football weekend between both college and the NFL. And I have to be honest, this was probably the toughest week to do it. If you look at the 2 slates, at least on paper, not all that great. We have 17 games tomorrow in college football involving at least one ranked team. 6 of the 7 games feature a spread of over 3 touchdowns. And so there's expected to be a lot of blowouts. And then in the NFL, it's the first time in a long time that we have, I think it's 3 games, maybe 4, where again you have teams favored by 13 points or more. We have some big spreads in both Saturday and Sunday. Now, as you know about football, right, it can be very unpredictable. But on paper, they're expecting, we are expecting, Vegas is, everyone's expecting a lot of blowouts this weekend, and we may not get a ton of interesting games. With that said, I stayed up all night. I worked very hard. I combed through this, and I found the 5 most interesting games of the football weekend for our tasty top 5.
This is a tasty burger.
It's the Tasty Top 5.
I'm tasty.
Number 5.
I'm going USC Notre Dame. Now, you know, you always think back to probably when you were growing up. And when I was growing up, USC Notre Dame, you had the whole Bush push, right? You had USC at the top of their game. But then you also had Brady Quinn and Notre Dame, and when Charlie Weiss had them going, and they were two of the more interesting programs in college football, and they would play every year, and they were iconic games. So I have always had a soft spot. I don't like either one of these programs, but I've always had a soft spot for this rivalry. I love to see them either play in Notre Dame with the jerseys, classic jerseys on both sides, especially USC, or even when they play out west. I always like watching this game. Now, for this year, maybe not the most interesting. USC isn't that great. Notre Dame is good, but really not in the playoff hunt at the moment after their loss to Cincinnati. But still, you get that rivalry. They're playing at Notre Dame. It's going to be a little cold, so you get like a classic Notre Dame game, USC coming to town here late October. I still think it's interesting. I still like to watch that rivalry matchup, even if it's not as much of a rivalry as maybe it once was. There's been a couple of blowouts lately, but I always am intrigued by that matchup. Just seeing those uniforms on the field together, I don't know. It gets me going. Something about it takes me back to the good old days of those two programs battling every year, you know, 15 years ago. I love it. So I put that at number 5. Number 4, Oklahoma State at Iowa State. Because Oklahoma State is a top 10 team, and yet they're a touchdown underdog. It's the first time this has happened in decades where you have a top 10 team as an underdog against an unranked team that large. So you have Oklahoma State, who's trying to make a run to the playoff. They're trying to make it come down to them and Oklahoma in the Big 12. And yet Vegas doesn't think they'll even get past Iowa State this weekend, who, Iowa State, remember, was the team in the Big 12 at the start of the season. Everyone was picking them to make the playoff. They've lost a couple of games, but they still have a good coach. They're coming off a bye. They're a tough team. So Oklahoma State, Iowa State is a very interesting game tomorrow because you have this weird scenario of Oklahoma State, a top 10 team, serving as a touchdown underdog to an unranked team with multiple losses. This is Oklahoma State's season. Right? You probably can't afford a loss, especially with Oklahoma still on the schedule coming up. And plus, there's still this fraudulent aspect that even though they're ranked 8th, people look at Oklahoma State and say, right? They're kind of like what everyone was saying about Iowa. And then Iowa laid an egg against Purdue. Maybe Oklahoma State will lay that egg against Iowa State tomorrow. Number 3 of the most interesting games, Bengals-Ravens, as we shift to the NFL. The NFL really only has 2 games of interest on Sunday. This is one of them, Bengals-Ravens. Now, the Ravens are favored by a touchdown, so Vegas isn't buying into Cincinnati, much like I haven't this year. They are better than I thought, but this is the big game. If the Bengals win this game, they're tied for the Ravens for first place. And obviously would just have beaten Baltimore and would have done it on the road. So here's a huge opportunity. I say this every week about the Bengals, but this is the real litmus test. Like, okay, right, you've gotten off to a good start. You almost beat Aaron Rodgers 2 weeks ago. You just blew out the Lions, as you should. How do you match up with Baltimore? Because that's the team to beat in that division. And this is the Bengals' chance to show, hey, you better take this seriously. Baltimore, you as well. If they go to Baltimore's building, Joe Burrow plays well, and they beat the Ravens, right? And now they're in first place, beating the Ravens, then I guess you really have to take them seriously. So a big opportunity for the Bengals on Sunday, an interesting game, Bengals-Ravens. Number 2 of the games to pay attention to this weekend, Clemson-Pittsburgh. I think this is the game of the weekend in college football. Now, maybe I'm biased because of where we're located, but I'm very intrigued by this matchup because for a number of different reasons. Clemson, an underdog against an ACC team for the first time in 8 years. Clemson is playing a ranked team in the conference as an unranked team for the first time in 11 years. You have Pittsburgh at home favored by 3.5, and Pittsburgh right now is playing like maybe the best team in the conference. Them or Wake Forest. And Clemson goes on the road, first time they're playing in Pittsburgh since 1947. And what I'm most interested about is the matchup. Because you have kind of polar opposites. Pittsburgh's all about their offense, top 10 offense. Clemson is a bottom 20 offense. But Clemson has a top 10 defense. So you have this really good offense scoring 50 points a game against that good defense. And what I'm most intrigued by is how much can Clemson limit Pittsburgh? Can they hold them to half of their points, 24? That seems reasonable. That seems like a good day. 24 may seem like a lot to Pittsburgh, especially the way Clemson has dominated Pittsburgh the last couple of matchups. But they're scoring almost 50 points a game. They have a quarterback who's turned it over just once. He's a Heisman candidate. They're going to be playing at their place in Pittsburgh. Outdoors, going to be a little. It could be a little chilly tomorrow. So if you give up 24 points, I think that's a good day at the office for the defense. The flip side, though, what about the offense for Clemson? Will they finally get going? Can they score 25? Can they exceed 20 points in regulation against the Power 5 team for the first time? And it just continues to be interesting, number one, to see Clemson, if and when they're going to bounce back. And we continue to expect them to look like the Clemson of old. But also, number two, they're still defending their castle here in these matchups. Right? Pittsburgh is ranked. They're in first place in the Coastal. They have their eyes on the prize of winning the ACC this year. Clemson could still say, hold on, I know we're not our usual selves, but this is still our conference. And try to put a Pittsburgh in their place. Try to put Wake Forest in their place in a couple of weeks, at least in the sense of beating them and showing, yeah, you're still not on our level. As bad as of a year we're having, you're still not caught up to us. A lot of intrigue around this game for me tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it, Clemson-Pittsburgh. And number one, the game of the weekend, Chiefs-Titans. I would look at the over in this game because you have two bad defenses and two offenses that can really move the football. But this is an intriguing game because for the Chiefs, last week they played really well in the second half against the Washington football team. Is that them coming out of their funk, or was that just them taking advantage of a bad team? And for the Titans, they had that big win against the Bills on Monday Night Football. And now in a short week, turnaround, welcome in the Chiefs. It's another test for the Titans. They're 4-2, but I don't think any of us are really sold on the Titans at 4-2. And the Chiefs aren't the normal Chiefs, but you beat the Chiefs at home less than a week after beating the Bills, right? The two best teams in the AFC a year ago. That goes a long way for the Titans. I think we see a lot of points in this game. They're two of the teams that were expected to be two of the best in the AFC. Two explosive offenses. I think it's going to be a very intriguing and fun matchup Sunday. And those are the five best games of the football weekend. A little bit later on, we'll look at who can be on upset alert here this weekend in college football. But when we come back, we'll start to get ready for the Gamecocks as they take on Texas A&M tomorrow. We'll get the opponent scouting report from someone who covers Texas A&M when we return. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
You're listening to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Try to catch up with Travis Brown, who covers Texas A&M, to get our opponent's scouting report as we look ahead to that matchup tomorrow. Texas A&M favored by almost 3 touchdowns at home for the 7:30 kick tomorrow against the Gamecocks. And we'll try to get that opponent breakdown from Travis Brown. I gave you my tasty top five last segment, the five most interesting games of the football weekend. If you ever miss anything from the show, you can always catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. You can also find those podcasts online at charlestonsportsradio.com or through our free app. Just search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. Every week, not only do I give you the most interesting games of the football weekend, but also a couple of teams that could be on upset alert. And there's a few out there that you look at, especially the Big Ten, because next week is the big week for the Big Ten. But I don't think this week will provide much drama. There's always the concern of the look ahead, right? So next week we have Michigan and Michigan State. Not only that rivalry, but two top 10 undefeated teams, as long as Michigan gets past Northwestern tomorrow, as they should. So the concern would be, you know, some sort of look ahead for Michigan as they get ready for Michigan State. But Michigan's at home. Northwestern is not very good. They don't have much of an offense. So I don't think that's a spot where you have to worry about Michigan being let down. And then also next week in the Big Ten, Halloween weekend, you have Penn State going to Ohio State. So just as I was saying, this weekend doesn't have a ton of great football games on paper. Next weekend in the Big Ten alone is incredibly interesting. But this weekend, tomorrow, as we get ready for those games, Ohio State has to travel to Indiana as a 3-touchdown favorite. Again, I would not put Ohio State on upset alert. I know a lot of people like Indiana in terms of the point spread, thinking that Indiana could keep this close, maybe be a little bit more of a dogfight. Indiana has been beat up this year on turnovers. and turnovers you can't really predict from game to game. They're at home tomorrow. You know, teams usually get up for a big-time opponent. If they take care of the football, they could hang in there tomorrow against Ohio State and that defense. Plus, you know, they gave them fits a year ago. It's a night game in Bloomington tomorrow night. But I don't think Ohio State will have to worry about losing that game. I don't think Penn State would have to worry about Illinois coming to their building. I don't think Michigan has to really worry about Northwestern. But those are, if there's ever a trap game, right, those are them. You're playing a bad team this week, Northwestern, Indiana, Illinois, all under 500. You get a bad team this week with the biggest game of your season next week. There's that trap, that look ahead. I don't think it happens in the Big Ten. Some may believe Michigan should be on upset alert. I think they handle Northwestern. Another game of interest would be Wake Forest and Army. Wake Forest is one of those teams. Are you bought into them yet? Do you buy that Wake Forest is the best team in the ACC, or they are a top 20 team? Because I'm not so sure. We've seen them get off to good starts and then fade as the season goes on, and you know, they get into your conference schedule and you're a little more battle tested. This obviously is a non-conference game, but they go to Army. And Army, we talk about this all the time at the Citadel. In fact, this was one of the talking points this week as we get ready for the Citadel in Western Carolina tomorrow. It's a new coaching staff at Western Carolina. They haven't had to face the option this year. Not sure when the last time is that they faced the option. And it's just something so unique that you have to prepare for. Now for Wake Forest, they're coming off a bye, so they got an extra week to get ready for this option attack. But they go to Army. They're going to face a team that is so unique from anything that they're used to dealing with. And Army, like all of these, you know, Army, Navy, even an Air Force, even the Citadel, the reason why they hang in there with these better teams, it's the same reason why they run the option to begin with. You shorten the game, you possess the football, you give yourself more of a chance. Wake Forest is only a 3-point favorite. Wake Forest is the number 16 team in the country going to Army. They're only favored by 3. I thought about putting this in the Tasty Top 5 because I think it is a very interesting game. And I would put Wake Forest on upset alert. The one thing holding me back, and maybe this has no bearing on the game, it probably won't, but the fact that Army, I looked this up last night because I was curious, because I always feel like I have this thought process, right? Sometimes you think something, and then you look up the data, and you realize, like, oh, actually, I was wrong all these years. And I always thought it was this one way. Turns out, I had it all wrong. But it always seems like that. Well, it always seems like these teams, Army, Navy, they give ranked teams fits. Right, I remember a close game with Oklahoma a couple years ago. That was against Army. Right, when didn't they take them to overtime? So I looked it up, and I thought, okay, it feels like these schools always give ranked teams a hard time. I did the research last night. Army is only 1-42 against ranked teams since 1973. And that one win was when Navy was ranked 25th in the country. So if you take away when they were playing another school like themselves, 0-42 against ranked teams in almost 50 years. And so I thought, you know what? Maybe that was a misconception. Maybe they do give them a hard time because Army-Navy, it's hard to blow out those teams when they shorten the game. You don't have as many possessions, but they don't actually beat those ranked teams very often. Army has not beaten a ranked team not named Navy since 1972. So I said, nope, I'm going to cross that off the list. Wake Forest, I was considering, you know, picking that as an upset. Maybe Army even beats them outright. I think it'll be a close game, hence the 3-point line. But I do think Wake Forest will survive. So that takes me to my two actual upset alerts. Oregon going to UCLA. Now, I guess this technically isn't an upset because UCLA is favored. But I just, when I talk about upset alert, what I mean is a ranked team that could lose and lose to an unranked team. If you're a ranked team that loses to, you know, you're a top 10 team, you lose to another top 10 team, that's not an upset. But if you're a number 10 team, even if you're the underdog, as Oregon is at UCLA, still, if you're the number 10 team in the country, you should not lose to an unranked team. You shouldn't even be the underdog to an unranked team. But that's the case for Oregon going to UCLA. And everybody I see is picking UCLA to win this game, which actually makes me a little cautious thinking that Oregon will have to actually win. But UCLA is better in the trenches. Chip Kelly going up against his old team. And UCLA has a little bit more of an explosive or dynamic offense. Plus, they're at home against Oregon. So, Oregon is the number 10 team in the country. They have to look out tomorrow on the road against UCLA. And the other game, I mentioned it earlier, and again, they are underdogs, so I'm not really going out on a limb here, but it's Oklahoma State going to Iowa State. Now, Oklahoma State is a top 10 team in the country. Iowa State is unranked, and yet Iowa State's favored by a touchdown tomorrow. That hasn't happened in decades. But the line is that way for a reason. I have plenty of concerns about Oklahoma State. They needed 19 unanswered points to get past Texas last week. And Iowa State is coming off a bye with a good coach. They're at home. Oklahoma State does not have a great offense. Iowa State, they have some talent on their offense. Breece Hall, that running back, is starting to get going. He led the country in yards a year ago. Iowa State plays great football in the month of October. So Oklahoma State, I think, is in trouble heading to Iowa State tomorrow, and that's why they're seven-point underdogs. Again, not really going out on a limb. Technically, I guess those wouldn't be upsets because they're two underdogs. But when I think of an upset alert, I'm thinking of a ranked team that's about to lose their ranking, or at least their positioning in the rankings, because they're going to lose to an unranked team. And that'll be the case here. Oregon better look out at UCLA as the number 10 team in the country. Oklahoma State better look out at Iowa State as the number 8 team in the country. We'll try to effort Travis Brown. Every Friday, we usually catch up with somebody from the other side of the matchup, get the scouting report on the opponent. Travis Brown covers Texas A&M. We may not be able to link up with him to get that opponent scouting report today. But for Texas A&M, obviously, you know, look, they beat Alabama 2 weeks ago. They come back, they beat Missouri, who's not a great team, but A&M playing better these last couple of weeks. They had to go to the backup quarterback, Zach Calzada, who's maybe getting more comfortable as things go along. And they're at home tomorrow night. The Gamecocks are coming to them. It's about a 3-touchdown line. It's going to be ugly. If you're the Gamecocks, you hope you can just hang in there. Right, but Texas A&M is a far superior team and program, and not an easy place to go and try to win a game on a Saturday night. Just ask Nick Saban and Alabama from 2 weeks ago. With that said, we will get the opponent scouting report as we connect now with Travis Brown, who covers Texas A&M for the Eagle. Follow him on Twitter at Travis_L_Brown. He's with us now. Travis, good afternoon. How are you?
Doing well. How are y'all?
Doing well. Appreciate the time as we get ready for this game tomorrow night. Let's talk about Texas A&M. Obviously, the huge win 2 weeks ago against Alabama. When that went down for you, was that a case of where did this come from, or is that a case of where has this been, you know, playing to this potential? What were your thoughts after that victory against Alabama?
A little bit of both, because I think that prior to the season, when everyone was healthy and they were expecting what A&M could put forth, that a close game against Alabama was something that everyone was geared up for. I mean, I think according to the secondhand market statistics, the prices of tickets for that game were going for like $400 still in the summer. But then Haynes King goes down and there's some injuries on the offensive line and things get shaky in Colorado and they drop two. And there was no signs that that was an offense that could really do much of anything to move the ball, and the defense didn't look especially good against Mississippi State the week prior. And so I think to that end, a week before, it was a little bit of where did this come from, because Zach Calzada played a game unlike he had played any time up to that point, and the offensive line finally showed some continuity and they were able to move the ball, and the defense got them some turnovers that helped push them ahead. So yeah, it was a little bit of perfect storm of both.
Yeah, so you mentioned Calzada, the offensive line. You know, maybe as the season goes on, two areas in which these guys are getting more comfortable. They beat Missouri last week. So in the last 2 weeks, coming from that Alabama win to Missouri and getting ready for the Gamecocks tomorrow, is this a case of this team kind of hitting a stride here, playing better the last couple of weeks? Or, again, going back to that Alabama game, was that kind of a one-off, like you said, perfect storm where everything came together in a performance that you haven't seen from them this year?
Yeah, I think there's certainly signs that things are still continuing to trend up. I think if you look at the Missouri game, some of the instances of things that had kind of plagued them in the games before popped back up. There was a little bit more inconsistency with Zach Calzada. He had a little bit of some happy feet at times, but he also completed a big third and 17 pass that kept Missouri from getting the ball back and having the ability to cut it to a one-score game in the third quarter. So the offensive line looked really good, especially in the run game. I know it was the worst run defense in the country, but they were able to kind of open up some holes at will. And so I think that there was a little bit maybe of the case of lightning in a bottle against Alabama, but they have been able to kind of keep a high level of progression on some of the improvements that they've made.
Now, Texas A&M will play Auburn coming up in 2 weeks. They have the bye, and then Auburn, a top 20 matchup as of today. They get the Gamecocks tomorrow at home, favored by about 3 touchdowns. Is there any concern or any chance of like a letdown game tomorrow where this game could be a little closer than maybe it's anticipated with Texas A&M coming off that win 2 weeks ago against Alabama, Auburn coming up in 2 weeks, but in the meantime, this Gamecock team coming to town?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jimbo Fisher has mentioned both the Missouri game and South Carolina games as trap games. He wants to make sure his team is geared up and ready to go, and I think that will be something that's on their mind because if they still want to, I think the expectations have been a little bit lowered because of those two losses from what they wanted to achieve, and that was getting into the college football playoff. But I mean, I think the mantra right now, whether it's plausible or not, is that they need to keep winning games, because if they keep winning games, and if some reason Alabama slips up here in their last handful of games, that there could be a chance that they could win a title if they keep winning. And I think that's been a little bit of the push from them. So you can expect that to be a little bit of the mantra heading into this game, and they still have some goals to achieve.
Two last things for you. Travis L. Brown covers Texas A&M for the Eagle. Number one, for tomorrow's matchup in particular, is there an area in which for this matchup against the Gamecocks, an area in which you see Texas A&M could be a little vulnerable for this game tomorrow?
I think it has to be the turnover game. I mean, South Carolina has been great at forcing turnovers this year, both in interceptions and fumbles, and Zach Calzada has thrown an interception in every game he's been in so far this season. And so I think that if – I know South Carolina has struggled a little bit on the offensive side of the ball, and so the defense can get them some short fields, not too dissimilar to what A&M was able to do against Alabama and really against Missouri last week as well, early in the game to jump out to an early lead. It's an A&M offense that works well when everything is kind of scripted and things are going in their favor. But when they've had to kind of fight from behind or had a little pressure on them, it certainly hasn't gone well for them this season. And I think if they can put the pressure on in that sense, that could be one way that South Carolina could jump out early on this A&M team.
And last thing I have to ask you, but Texas A&M comes to Columbia next year, actually a year from today. When they make that trip, is Jimbo Fisher still leading Texas A&M next year against the Gamecocks, or do you think he does go to LSU?
No, I really do think he'll stay at A&M. I think that there is certainly a lot of coach speak that happens when these instances come around where coaches say they're happy and they like the program and they like their administrators, but there is actually some tangible proof of him really laying down some roots here. He bought a whole bunch of land just outside of College Station, works with a company that is down here with a cattle company and has some livestock on the land. I know I talked at a story on how Marty and McGee from SEC Nation came down and shot all their commercials on his property heading into this season, and he was just giddy to get them on the Gator and show them all over the land. And I think he is really happy personally here, not to mention his wife tweeted out that she is very happy here as well and enjoys it. And the Aggies have been pretty good to him, but he has a Kids First Fund foundation that supports the disease that kind of afflicted his youngest and he's recovering from and some research for that. And I know after the Alabama game, that was 41-38, a whole bunch of Aggies donated $41.38 to the charity and raised over $100,000. And I think there's a mutual love there that would probably keep Fisher here, even if that LSU job came open. So, yeah, I think the next time the Bonham Trophy is on the line, Jimbo Fisher will still be the head coach of the Aggies.
He's Travis L. Brown, covers Texas A&M for the Eagle. Follow him on Twitter at Travis_L_Brown. Travis, appreciate the time and the insight, and enjoy the game tomorrow night.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
Hey, pleasure's all ours. Appreciate it from Travis Brown. We were able to catch up with him. Yeah, Jimbo, we played that audio the other day. You know, he did mention in that thanking the administration or saying how great they've been. And remember, that was the whole issue of him bailing on Florida State. That's the one difference. He felt like he wasn't getting the support at Florida State that he feels like it seems he's getting here at Texas A&M. And the great equalizer, as Travis mentioned, turnovers. For the Gamecocks, you want to pull an upset on the road, it's going to take a couple of turnovers. We'll see if they can get it done tomorrow. Calzada's a guy who can turn over the football. We'll wrap up hour one when we come back. Zeb Nolan starts tomorrow for the Gamecocks. What it means for their personnel situation. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Walking through the park, it wasn't quite dock, there was a man sitting on a bench. Out of the crowd as his head low.
Grabbing him hour one here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Appreciate the time. Last segment from Travis Brown, who covers Texas A&M. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. Zeb Nolan gets the start tomorrow for the Gamecocks against Texas A&M. He's the starting quarterback here moving forward. I think it speaks to the personnel situation the Gamecocks are in. I mean, we know this, that you have to fall back to this grad transfer or grad student, grad assistant, really, a coach, coming in to be a quarterback after the Luke Doty injury. Speaks to the thinness of that quarterback room. But not just this year, even if you go back and look at the personnel over the last couple of years. And I was thinking about this yesterday, and I went and I looked it up. You know, if you look at the last couple of offensive coordinators for the Gamecocks, everybody's upset this year at Marcus Satterfield, and he has left a lot to be desired. I've questioned plenty of his play calls and the way he operates an offense. But it seems like for years now we've been having these complaints about offensive coordinators for the Gamecocks. And, you know, sometimes you can only work with what you're dealt, or, you know, what you have to work with. You can only do so much. And so I went back and looked. You know, Mike Bobo is the offensive coordinator for the Gamecocks. Now he's at Auburn. Right now Auburn is scoring, or they're averaging their most points per game in 8 years. They're scoring 10 more points per game this year than they did a year ago. Bo Nix is having a career-high quarterback rating this year. Auburn is averaging over 30 more passing yards per game this season compared to last year. In fact, they have more passing yards per game this year than any other season for Auburn since 1997. And it's being done in year one of Mike Bobo there running the offense. He had success before and now having success after South Carolina. Before that, it was Brian McClendon. He's now the passing game coordinator at Oregon, second year there. They've had a different quarterback each of the last 2 years, having to replace Justin Herbert. And yet right now, second most points scored in the Pac-12, only 1 point behind the leader. You ever work a job where things are, they just don't work? They're more difficult. You're not getting the support, the resources like at other companies. Maybe it's more about the personnel than it is the play callers in Columbia. We'll preview Pittsburgh-Clemson when we come back with Hour 2. We'll be right back.